Thanks, Luke. You guys probably don't know this, but my wife Naomi and I, we kind of feel like we're a part of what you're doing here. So at least from afar, we've been praying for you guys and occasionally sticking our nose in, talking to you guys, and we're really excited to what's going on here. And honestly, last night I was talking with Luke and Gab, and they're sharing a bit about what some of you did over Easter and connecting with some different neighborhoods and communities, and one couple with sushi, and how you're seeking to engage your neighbors with the gospel in very normal but powerful ways. And that's what kind of makes my heart skip, is seeing the gospel be brought to bear, not just in sort of street preaching or handing out tracts, all those things have value, but is making the gospel part of our DNA. It's who we are. It's not just something we occasionally do. So I'm excited to see what you guys are doing. I think you guys are, from what I hear, beginning to live that out. And since this is my first time to be able to be with you officially as a church, I want to spend a little bit of time just reminding you of the purpose for God's people. From the very beginning of creation till today, that God has had a common purpose for his people, and that is a missionary purpose. So what I'd like to do is really briefly just go through the whole story of salvation and what God's plan is for me and for you as his people. And then afterwards, I'm going to briefly share about what's going on in Mexico City. So I'll try to combine those things. And then if you guys would like to know a little bit more about Mexico City or like to critique anything I said, then we can do that over lunch because I hear it's free. So that sound good? All right, let me pray and we'll get started. Father, I thank you so much for Redeemer Community Church. I thank you that you have brought this group of people together to glorify you and to make you known in this city. I ask God that you will empower them with love and truth and hope and grace, that the people that they share their lives with in the day-to-day, whether it's their neighbors or their coworkers or their mailman, that they will see something distinctly different about them because Jesus is transforming them as individuals and as a community day by day to his glory. I pray that you help me to explain well and correctly your word, and that you might use your word to impact my life and our lives, that we might be the people you've called us to be. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, one thing I love about, how many of you have taken basic Spanish at some point in your lives? At least basic Spanish. How many actually have met somebody who speaks Spanish? Oh, thank you. You live in San Antonio. That should be everyone. One thing I love about Spanish, I'm going to move this, is I love there's a difference between the word por qué and para qué. It's always confusing for an English speaker. Por qué means because. So in English we have one word for because. Por qué means the cause of this is. But in Spanish, because can mean two things. Por qué is the cause, and para qué is the purpose. So this morning I want to talk about the para qué of the church, the purpose of God's people. But to understand the purpose of God's people, you actually have to go back to the very beginning of creation itself, because that's where it starts. So I'm not going to teach one passage today. I generally prefer to do that. Instead, we're going to go through a series of passages and see the story of God's people develop throughout the scriptures. So if you're willing to, yeah, you can run along with me. We're going to start in Genesis chapter 1. If you don't know where that is, it's the very first page, all right? So hopefully you can find it. In Genesis chapter 1, we see the beginning of all things, the creation of the world. And it takes place over a six-day period. So we see God creating the earth. We see him separating the waters. We see him creating the fish and the birds and the animals. And every day, at the end of the day, God says, it is good. It is good. It is good. It is good. Which is good to remember because the world we live in today is not quite so good. But deep in its essence, there is something good about the world that God has created. But at the end of the sixth day, God isn't done because it's still incomplete. And so on the sixth day, we come to the culmination of God's creation plan. And the culmination of that plan is found in man and woman, Adam and Eve. So in Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28... God says, in verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And then he goes on in verse 31, and he says, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. So God is amazingly, beautifully, creatively creating and shaping this world, and he says it's good, it's good, it's good. And then he comes to the man and the woman, he creates them, and he creates them in his image, and he says, now it is very good. Now it is amazingly, wonderfully good. Because the creation of man and woman is the culmination of God's creative purposes. And the text is interesting because unlike all the other creatures, unlike the fish and the birds and the animals, both man and woman are created in the image of God. And that has all sorts of amazing implications for us. This really isn't central to the sermon, but I want to say it because it's important. Being created in the image of God means that we have intrinsic value. So when we talk about self-esteem, for example, there is no such thing as genuinely high or low self-esteem. There's just misplaced self-esteem. Because we find our value in being created in the image of God, it can't be added to and it can't be taken away from because it is secure, because God is secure. Does that make sense? So if we find our value in God himself, it can never vary. Whether or not you have a job, whether or not your kids like you, whether or not you're beautiful or ugly or whatever it is, you are of intimate, amazing value because you're created in the image of God. That's really a foundational piece for anything we do as Christians. And it's the one lesson I don't know about you, but I have to relearn every day because I keep trying to find my value in other things, even in good things like my ministry or my marriage, not in my good looks. That's a challenge. I have to find my value exclusively in the fact that God created me in his image, and particularly in light of Jesus, I am uniquely loved. Nothing can take away, nothing can add. It is firm and secure. Now, God gave Adam and Eve two unique commands. They're created in his image, and the Bible doesn't say exactly what that means, but part of that it says is they are meant to fill the world with other human beings, have lots and lots of babies and grandbabies and great-grandbabies. And secondly, they're called to take dominion over the earth. What God is really calling them to do in the dominion part is he's telling them that they are his representatives to the world. So as they rule over his creation, they are ruling as his representatives. And that is one of the key ways that they reflect his image to the creator of the world. Does that make sense? So ruling over the world is really a way of reflecting his image and his glory to the world. Filling the world with babies is really the same thing as well. If Adam and Eve fill the world with men and women, boys and girls, created in the image of God, they've just filled the world with what? With the image of God. So God created Adam and Eve. He created humanity in his image so that they might fill his world with his image and reflect his glory to the universe. That is the chief end of man, to know him and to make him known from the very beginning. And Adam and Eve, they did that perfectly, right? They reflect his image perfectly throughout the world and everything's beautiful and wonderful now. Is that right? No, they messed it all up. They decided to break relationship with God and to seek to be wise on their own, to live on their own, and they ruined everything. The world is still good, but it is deeply, deeply flawed. It is now a deeply broken world. Everything wrong in your life in one sense, springs from what Adam and Eve did. They broke relationship with God. They severed relationship with the life giver, the truth giver, the grace giver. That doesn't mean that the image of God is ruined. We are still created in the image of God. But it is now deeply distorted. It is a messed up image. God, however, is not one to give up quickly. He did not give up on his plan. He didn't say, man, they screwed it up, and this is the end of it. No more humans. I'm working with the dogs, you know. He continues with his plan. And so years later, there's a man named Abram in Genesis chapter 12, if you can turn there. In Genesis chapter 12, God calls this man named Abram, who appears to have been from a very broken pagan background himself. And God's going to call this man to continue with his purpose for humanity. It says in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 and following, "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" So God created Adam and Eve to reflect his image, his glory to the world, to fill his world with his glory. And they failed. But God continues to work through broken people. We come to this point, he calls this man Abram, and he says that Abram is to be blessed so that he might what? So that he might be a blessing. So that all the families of the earth will be blessed in him. God is calling Abraham to once again fill his world with blessing. God didn't call Abraham for himself. I'm sure God loved Abraham. But Abraham was not the end game. The end game is God continuing to fulfill his purposes through humanity. Through Abraham, through his family, ultimately through his seed, Jesus, all the nations of the earth were to be blessed. That was the purpose for calling Abraham, was to bless the nations. And then a few years later, about 400 years later, his family has grown. They have become a nation of people, but they're enslaved in Egypt. If you guys have ever seen the movie Prince of Egypt, it's pretty good. It's a good summary of the story. God has grown, has blessed his family, but they find themselves in slavery, and even that's part of God's plan, because God now is going to work through his family. He's going to bring them liberty from slavery in Egypt. He's going to liberate them with power and signs and wonders with a very specific purpose so that the nations might know him. If you go back and read the Exodus account, you'll see that actually again and again. God is doing this so that the people might know that he is a true God. They leave Egypt and they come into the desert and they come to the mountain where they'll receive the law. And God says in Exodus, you can turn there, Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19. God's going to tell them why he saved them, what their purpose is as God's people. He says in Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 through 6. Verse 5 through 6, he says, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Do any of you have a Roman Catholic background? Anyone here? All right. In Mexico, everyone has a Roman Catholic background. What does a priest do? What's the role of a priest in Roman Catholicism? Good. Yeah, he stands between God and man. The priest mediates God's presence to men and brings men to God. Now, we don't believe that today, but that's what a priest does. A priest mediates God's presence to people. And people come to know God through the priest. Well, what did God just tell Israel they are going to be? A kingdom of priests and a holy nation. See, one of Israel's great failures throughout history is that they kept believing that God saved them for themselves. Everyone else was the enemy. They were the special people, and that's all that mattered. When you read the Gospels, you guys just went through Passion Week. When you read the Gospels, that's what's going on with the Jewish leaders. Israel is God's special people, and everyone else is the enemy. But that's not what God said. God called Israel to do the same thing he called Adam and Eve to do. He called Israel to do the same thing he called Abraham to do. To fill the world with his image, with his glory, with his blessing. The nations were meant to come to know God through Israel. Through their holy living. Through their righteous community. Through their pursuit of God. The nations were meant to come to know the true and living God in a saving way. That was the purpose of Israel, to be a light to the nations. God did not save Israel for themselves. God saved Israel for the sake of the world. Does that make sense? Did Israel do it? Was Israel a light to the nations? Most of the time they weren't. You have a few brief periods, particularly during David's life and a little bit of Solomon's life, the first half, where the nations begin to come to know God through Israel. But then they began to live just like the other nations. They chose the same path as Adam and Eve, to break relationship with God, to live on their own, to be like the nations instead of living for the nations. And so they actually gave the world a false view of God, a corrupted view of God. They failed to mediate the true presence of God, the saving presence of God, to the world. And their failure to do so wasn't just a personal failure. It robbed the world of the hope of salvation. Humanly speaking, if they did not live as a kingdom of priests, as a righteous nation, if they were not light for the nations had no light. There were not alternative means to come to know God. This was God's plan. And because of their sin and their brokenness, and their rebellion, they messed it all up. And so God, in his perfect love and wisdom and power, decided to make it right himself. Adam and Eve failed to do it. Israel failed to do it. And that was the story of last week. That God himself became a man, the person of Jesus. He lived the righteous life. He was the holy nation. He was the perfect sacrifice, and he made himself the perfect priest. Now, we could read the whole, all four Gospels to talk about that, but one passage in particular, I just read it quickly, 45, Mark 10, 45. I'm leading an outreach study of the Gospel of Mark in Mexico, and this is one of those really powerful passages that summarizes why Jesus came. Mark chapter 10, verse 45. He says, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Jesus came for the sake of the world, to give his life as a ransom for many. But the story doesn't end on Easter Sunday. He didn't just resurrect and that was the end of the story, because he still has the same purpose for the world. He wants to fill his world with his glory, and he wants to do it by means of a transformed people. God is obstinate in his purposes. He will accomplish what he wants to accomplish. Adam and Eve failed, but the mission continued. He calls Abraham. Abraham's family ends up in slavery. It appears a failure, and God rescues them, and he calls them to be a kingdom of priests, to be a holy nation, and they fail, and so he breaks the bond of slavery and death himself. And he brings new life through his resurrection, but he's not done because he's still about creating a people. And so that's what he does. You guys have been studying the book of Acts, right? That's what he does. Jesus raised from the dead in order to create a new people who will fulfill the original purpose of being a light to the nations. If you'll turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 2, this all comes to culmination in many ways in 1 Peter. It's right before 2 Peter. So you know you're close if you're there. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 through 10, Peter explains who the church is and the para qué, the purpose of the church, what they're for. And you're going to find that it matches quite well with the purpose of Adam and Eve and of Abraham and of Israel. He says in chapter 2, verse 9 and 10, "But you," speaking to the church, "but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." Does that sound familiar at all? Verse 9 in particular? Because we just read it. This is a quote from Exodus 19, verse 6. Peter is using language that once described Israel to now describe the church. Now, I personally don't believe that the church replaces Israel. That's a whole other theological issue. But what it does do is the church has the same purpose as Israel. It hasn't changed. Where Israel failed, God has now called a new people into existence, not through the law, but through the death and resurrection of Jesus, through the life of the Spirit, but the purpose remains the same. The church is called to be a chosen race. A new race of people where Jew and Gentile no longer matter. Where it doesn't matter if you're Mexican or Irish or Spanish or American or Gypsy or African-American or Asian. We form a new chosen race. And that we are a royal priesthood. The same question, what does a priest do? Mediates God's presence to the world. People draw near to God through the priest. He says, we are a royal priesthood. We are the family of the king, and we have a priesthood that we are expected to exercise in this world. If the world does not come to know God through the church, it will not come to know God. We are the means by which the world comes to know him. God could send out angels to proclaim the gospel, but he doesn't. Heck, he could send out donkeys to preach the gospel, but he doesn't. From the very beginning, his plan has been to make himself known through a transformed community of people. We are a priesthood, not just as individuals. We are a priesthood as a community. We, as a local church, mediate God's presence to San Antonio. And he wants San Antonio to come to know God through his church, through their gospel lives, through their gospel actions. He calls us a holy nation. We are now set apart. Our passports don't matter. We are set apart people for him. We are his unique possession, his special possession. We are uniquely loved. And then we have this, so that, the para qué, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. That's why. That's why you're chosen. That's why you are uniquely loved. That's why you've been made a priesthood, is to proclaim his glory, his beauty, his excellencies. The church has this tendency to think that God saved us for ourselves. And I have no doubt that God deeply loves me. And when Jesus died on the cross, he had all my wretchedness in mind. But he didn't save me for myself. He saved me to be part of a transformed community that offers transforming, life-giving hope to the world. That's the purpose of the church. That's the purpose in everything that we do. And what's interesting is Peter in particular, Peter is an interesting book. He talks a lot about suffering. But he also goes on to talk about mission, this mission of God's people. And he doesn't say that we proclaim God's excellencies primarily through sending people overseas, like me. Oh, that's super important. He doesn't say that we proclaim his excellencies primarily through our preaching on Sunday mornings. He doesn't say we proclaim his excellencies primarily through preaching in the street or having evangelistic activities or giving out tracts. None of those things are bad. But that's not what Peter says. Peter has gone to give a list of how we live out this missional calling. He says we live it out by living as a transformed community in the midst of daily, normal, boring life. That's where we proclaim God's excellencies. An occasional outreach event is great, but Peter says that the gospel is made known to the world through our daily living as individuals and as a community. And just really quickly, I can't spend too much time on this, but I'm going to go through what he says. Can I have some of you read a few passages for me? Is that all right? Can I have some volunteers? All right, I want you to read 1 Peter chapter 2, all 1 Peter, all right, verses 11 and 12. I need another volunteer now. All right, can you please read 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 through 15? I'm just going to go through. Somebody else. All right, can you please read 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 18? Can you please read 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 through 21? Somebody else? I want to make you all involved. All right. Daniel, how about 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 2? Somebody else? 1 Peter 3, verse 7. Got one? 1 Peter 3, verses 8 through 9. And one last, Mark. 1 Peter 3, 15 through 16. All right. So we'll go through this very, very quickly, all right? We won't spend all day here today. But Peter says we live out our lives as a kingdom of priests. We proclaim the glories of God, his excellencies, by means of really normal things. How about, first of all, 1 Peter 2, 11 through 12. Can you read it really loud? Excellent. We make God known through our honorable conduct. It's pretty simple, isn't it? By honorable conduct, we shut the mouths of those who accuse us falsely, and we hope, I think this indicates, that they will see our good deeds and they'll glorify God in the day of Jesus' return. They'll come to know him through our very basic good deeds at the gym, in our workplace, at the park, with our waiter. Our honorable deeds will bring gospel transformation. How about 1 Peter 2, 13 through 15?
Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors, and to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, to the praise of those who do good. This is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men.
Good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. And it's interesting, particularly doing good by respecting our governing authorities. Think of that next time you publicly make fun of our president or your local representative. By doing good, we make Jesus known. How about 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 18? Excellent. Now, most of you aren't servants in a slave sense, but you have a job. You've chosen to be a servant. He tells servants, in our situation, employees, to be subject to their bosses with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. This is an overflow of what it means to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, to proclaim his excellencies. Be a good worker, even if you have a lousy boss. How about 1 Peter 2, 20 through 21?
What credit is it if, when you sin and are for it, you endure? But if you, when you do good and suffer for it, you endure. This is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps.
Good. We make Christ known by suffering graciously like Christ. Americans in particular have a really hard time being mistreated. We have a very developed sense of our personal rights. But Jesus set an example for us. He suffered righteously and he suffered graciously. God is made known. His image is reflected when we do the same. How about 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 2? The gospel is made known by wives being gracious wives, by wives submitting to their husbands in love and hope and truth. The image of God is reflected in a godly woman. How about 1 Peter 3, 7? Go ahead.
Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered.
So the opposite side is that men make Christ known by living with their wives in an understanding way. Treating their wives in an understanding, caring, comprehensive manner. That's how the excellencies of God are proclaimed in marriage. Two more. 1 Peter 3, 8 through 9.
Of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, an humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless, for to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing.
Thank you. This is community life. Christ is made known by developing and encouraging Christ-like relationships. We are of united mind. We have sympathy for one another. He's talking to you people, so listen. Brotherly love, a tender heart, a humble mind. It is as God's people live together in a transformed way that the gospel is made known. Jesus says something similar in John 13:35. He says, all people will know that you're my disciples if you have love for one another. He's talking about the church, about his people. Now we should love other people as well, because if you will love each other, they will know you're my people. So one of the questions is, when do people ever see you love one another? See, if we hide ourselves away in our church building or our hotel or our home, and we don't live life together with and before non-believers, they will never see our love for one another, and they will not see this unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, tender heart, humility. They won't see it. But when we share our lives together and with our non-believing friends and families and networks of relationships, what happens? They see a transformed people. A people that smell like Jesus. That happens at the park, at a restaurant, on the football field. That's normal stuff. That's where people see us love each other. And they see the transforming work of Jesus that they can't deny. One final passage. 1 Peter 3, 15 through 16. Who has that? Mark.
But in your hearts, honor Christ, the Lord is holy, always being prepared to make an offense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame.
The final way we live out this transformed life, we proclaim Christ's glory, is by being ready. Always being ready. Always being ready to share why. And the interesting thing about 1 Peter 3, it says to those who ask. If we live in a transformed way, people will actually ask. If they see us living in a radically different way, if the gospel is being fleshed out in our marriages, in our workplace, in our children, and that doesn't mean being perfect or even looking like we're perfect. That means messing up big time and seeking forgiveness because people don't do that. That means yelling at my kids and then genuinely saying, I am sorry. That means my neighbor seeing my marriage get better over the next 5 years instead of getting worse. That means me messing up my job and taking responsibility for it. They will see something different. You may not feel all that different. You kind of look at yourself in the mirror and you're like, I look like everybody else. We look like every other club of people. But God tells us that we're not. You have to believe that because it's true. The Spirit of God is uniquely working in your life individually and as a community. And that means something different is happening. One little interesting story, and you can do what you want with this. We lived in two places in Mexico City. Our first home was in the northwest part of the city. And one day, our neighbor, who we didn't know, this woman comes over to Naomi, and she says, what angel did you bring with you? And Naomi says, I don't know what you mean. And she says, the man who lived behind you, who shares the same wall, your back wall, he would scream and break glass every night for the last year. He would scream and break glass every night for the last year, and that's one of the reasons why the people who lived before you moved. And since you moved in, he stopped. What did you bring with you? Now, I'm not being sort of rabid Pentecostal, just so you know. But last I checked, the Bible talks about powers and principalities and demons. And I can't say what was happening exactly in that man's life. We did hear him twice the first week we moved in. We never heard him again. But when I hear what the man was doing for a year, every night, it reminds me of the man possessed with a legion of demons who hurt himself with rocks and couldn't be contained. And what was interesting is we didn't come in and cast some demon out of some man. I didn't come in with my Christian authority and say, boom, you know. But this is what I'm convinced of. We have the Spirit of God. My wife and I, we're Christians. And he lives in us, and he's present among us. And I think God shut that man up. And he made our neighbor take notice. So Naomi could tell her, I don't have an angel, but God's with us. God is with us. If you are a follower of Jesus, the Spirit of the living God, we just sang about it. He was sent to us as a community to live transformed lives and to transform people's lives. That's my message. That's who we are. You as a church, don't forget that. You'll be inclined to get distracted by structures, by programs, by buildings, by figuring out how to take care of all these crazy kids. There are lots of distractions, but the mission is there. God has called us into existence to be a light to the nations, and we're a light to the nations, not just when we do religious events. We're a light to the nations in the normal, boring moments of life, particularly when we do it together. The New Testament is written to a group of people, groups of people, not to individuals, a few exceptions. As you live life together in a transformed way, Jesus will make himself known, and people will come to know him.